Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Kara Dansky and Amy Souza. Kara Dansky is a feminist and an attorney. She serves on the steering committee of the U.S. chapter of the Women's Human Rights Campaign and chairs the Women's Human Rights Campaign's Committee on Law and Legislation. She's currently coordinating the Women's Human Rights Campaign's plan to present a panel at the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. Amy Souza is a theater educator, director, and longtime radical feminist. She's been outspoken on the defense of women's rights through social media, YouTube, and writing. So first off, thank you both for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being in the program.
Thanks for having us, Derek.
Thank you.
So you have an event coming up. Can you talk about the event that you're planning?
So we are planning a picketing event on Women Picket DC on March 8th of 2021 in front of the White House. And this is an event that we began in order to protest Biden's executive order, which he signed on January 20th, 2021. In that order, he interprets sex broadly as sexual orientation and gender identity, but it doesn't really make any provisions for the physical category of sex, which in what that means for women and girls and female people is that we'll no longer be a legally protected class once that order is implemented. So our event is a way for women and girls to speak up and stand up and show solidarity and voice our anger and dissent at being eliminated as a sex class and having our rights to single-sex provisions and sports be basically under attack by this executive order. So we've organized a number of women. We have a number of, we have, you know, a few hundred women that we expect to be there, and probably about 50 women who are in our volunteer campaign. And we're really just, drumming up media and trying to make our voices heard as much as we can.
So you may have used some words that people might not be familiar with. Can you sort of go back to basics and talk about what this is? I mean, you mentioned sex, gender identity, sexual orientation. What do all those words mean?
Those are great questions. Gender identity is a term used in the executive order. However, that term is never explicitly defined within the order, which is a problem. Really, what gender identity is, it's an umbrella term that covers, you know, literally hundreds of self-claimed personal identities. The one that people are probably most familiar with is the trans identity, which again is never explicitly defined within the order. But the general idea of it, if you, you know, do a search for it on Google, is that gender is something that people can choose that sort of supersedes their sex. It's basically saying that the category of sex is something that you can identify into or out of. Sex itself is an immutable category that, you know, has to do with how a person's body is organized. So basically, human beings, and this is not just true of human beings, this is true of all mammals. Human beings have either bodies that are organized around the production of large immobile gametes or eggs, and those people are female, or they can have bodies organized around the production of small mobile gametes, and those people are male. Those categories of sex are immutable categories. whereas the category of gender identity is a very undefined category and one that is self-ascribed by the people who claim those identities. The category of sexual orientation is also not clearly defined, but sexual orientation would cover people who are gay, lesbian, straight. And the category of sexual orientation has to do with sex. It actually has to do with the immutable categories of sex. It's a way to be attracted. Females attracted to females are lesbian. Males attracted to males are gay. And straight people are attracted to the opposite sex. And bisexual people are attracted to both sexes.
So could I maybe jump in here for a minute?
Please, of course.
Okay, thanks. So maybe if I could just provide a little bit of additional context, because I think sometimes these issues tend to get very confused in conversation when they really don't need to be. And so if we go back and we look at the history, let's just keep it within the United States, because all three of us live in the United States. We could have a much larger conversation about how women are treated in the law globally, but let's just keep it narrowly defined to the U.S. So it's no mystery that women have been treated horrifically in U.S. law since before the founding of the Republic, right? We can go back centuries. And for example, I have dug up a pre-colonial Massachusetts law that punished women, made it punishable by death for women to quote unquote lure men into marriage by wearing high heels. We know, for example, that no state in the United States permitted women to vote. We were not allowed any participation in the government in terms of having a say in terms of how our society would be operated. So this continued over the centuries, and feminists have made a tremendous amount of progress in terms of getting women's sex-based rights enshrined in the law, right? We're now allowed to vote. We're allowed to serve on juries. These are great things. However, also over the course of the last couple of decades, we've started to see this very amorphous concept called gender identity sort of creep its way into the law. And a lot of people don't know that because the media does a horrific job of covering that. And so I'm really grateful to you, Derek, for having us on to explain. A lot of people truly just do not understand what is going on here. Most people tend to think that protecting gender identity or quote unquote trans is kind of a compassionate thing to do for a marginalized group of people. But that is absolutely not what's really happening. What is happening is that women's sex-based rights, which feminists have fought for so long, are being absolutely obliterated. I hope that's helpful context.
Yeah. So let's sort of get down into the nitty gritty or whatever. What does this mean? I mean, you've said that women's sex-based rights. You didn't use the word eroded, but is that word fair? And then, so what would be some of the sex-based rights? Let's go.
Yeah. Well,
what's happening? I mean, can you talk about, I don't know, women's sports, women's prisons, women's whatever?
Absolutely. So, women fought very hard to get Title IX enacted in the law in 1972. And what that law said was that it would be unlawful for recipients of federal money to discriminate against people on the basis of sex in the educational arena. It's come to be very closely associated with sports, but it really applies to the educational arena more generally. And the reason that that is important is that for centuries, the men in power making the laws did not feel that it was appropriate for women to participate actively in the educational arena, because they said that our bodies made us less than suitable to be able to learn and be educated with men. And also,
So in addition to sports, which is something you and I have talked about privately some, can you talk more about the women's explicit education? I mean, does this mean that a woman would be somehow disallowed from going to school in science because her lady brain can't handle it? Or what are you saying?
Yeah, because our lady brain can't handle it, or because it would be harmful to our lady bodies. I've literally read medical journals from the 17th and 18th centuries in which doctors argued that our bodies made us unsuitable to be educated, that getting a formal education would in fact harm our menstrual cycles and our ability to get pregnant. I'm not.
And this has been, you know, it's been going on since Aristotle. I mean, it goes way, way, way back. I mean, Aristotle said, you know, sort of ridiculous things like a woman's hair was long because we drew up semen through our colder, wetter bodies. And this is what made us unsuitable to be educated and unsuitable for public life. I mean, there's a, you know, thousands of history of men repeating this sort of mantra. I mean, Darwin said very similar things, and Laban, the French doctor, also said, you know, women were unsuitable because of our weaker, smaller brains.
So, and in terms of how this plays out in sports, of course, women's sports have traditionally not been very valued by our society. It's great to see that women like Serena Williams are able to compete. I'm just picking Serena Williams, but there's so many really notable female athletes, all of whom have benefited in some way from the enactment of Title IX in 1972. It's worth noting that after Title IX was enacted in 1972, the Department of Education put out regulations to implement the statute. And some of those regulations include provisions that it's acceptable to maintain specific sex-specific sports and facilities like bathrooms and locker rooms. And all of that is being threatened by gender identity ideology in general and by President Biden's January executive order in particular.
So let's back up again. So post-1972, that meant that if you have a high school that has a boys that has a boys track team where boys high jump, then that means if girls want to jump, they must be allowed to in a category and they don't have to jump against boys, but they get to have their own competitions. Is this basically what that boils down to?
It's basically what it boils down to. I'm sure there were practical questions about, you know, having enough girls to form an actual team, but yeah, that's the essence.
And so Let's come back to Biden in a second, but let's move to, say, 1980, 1990, and start talking about the rise of this backlash. Or can I use the word as this movement as a backlash against women's rights? Is that fair?
It is. It is in part a backlash against women's rights, certainly. I mean, it is the new misogyny. There's no question about that. And I don't know if you want to get into the context about the funding behind this movement, which has been growing and growing and growing for decades behind the scenes. Again, it's really important to understand that most people have no idea what's going on because this movement has accomplished its goals by stealth. I don't know the extent to which you want to get into that, but I just want to, you know, it bears repeating that if people are confused about this, that is perfectly understandable for the simple reason that this can be very confusing, although it need not be.
I'm going to jump forward again. Sorry. And yeah, I want to come back to funding and the stealth in a moment, but let's still lay down more of the basics. So in 1977, say, a girl wants to go out for high jumping or for she wants to make a basketball team and there's enough girls interested. The school has to do it if they have a boys team. Am I correct so far?
I believe so, yes.
Or at least she has to have the opportunity. It's raising opportunities. Okay, so now let's move to what are the implications of this? So is gender identity being substituted for sex? Is that what you're saying in the law?
Effectively, yes. And the practical implications of that cannot be overstated. So just as an example, feminists worked really, really hard to create networks of domestic violence shelters because they understood that women were being treated very badly by their intimate partners, including their husbands, and they often had nowhere to escape. So the reason that we have domestic violence shelters is that feminists created them to give women who were being brutally abused by male attackers a refuge away from those men. And they tended to be women only, of course. And what the impact of gender identity means in this context is that women-only shelters will not be permitted to reject allowing men in them with abused women.
And this is not a theoretical concern.
No, we know that it's already happened. One of the starkest examples happened in Vancouver, where a man was permitted to enter a women's domestic violence shelter where he sexually assaulted two women. And we've heard stories of it happening throughout the U.S. as well. I know of several examples moving from the domestic violence shelter context to the prison context. I have personally spoken with two women in a Texas prison who were required to share a locked prison cell with a man because the man stated that he, quote unquote, identified as a woman. Those are the magic words. Any man can say, I identify as a woman, and most states have policies in place that will mandate that the prison house such a man with females. So it's not theoretical at all.
And I've been working on these issues for a decade, and I still can't wrap my mind around the, I'm sorry to use a word that most people don't like, but the utter lunacy of that.
Yeah, and I think that's also part of why this is so hard, because, you know, I'll take a friend, for example. I started talking with him about this about 5 years ago, and he straight up didn't believe me because it is so outlandish to even imagine that state corrections departments are putting men in women's prisons, many of whom, by the way, have a very violent and sexual criminal records. And prison officials are putting them in locked prison cells with women. It is hard to get our brains around that because it is so it is so outlandish and it is so outrageous that most people do not believe that it is happening. But I promise you that it is.
I think that, you know, what's been really effective for the gender movement is they've had a lot of you know, what Jennifer Bilott covers, you know, their advertising campaigns, their sloganeering campaigns, and the NGOs that are already captured have been effective in the words that they've been using to promote this. And they use a lot of words that strike the hearts of progressives. They use words like inclusivity and human rights, you know, trans rights are human rights. And, you know, these words make people think that when they're supporting that movement, that they are being inclusive. However, women and girls are being excluded. Our rights of consent are being excluded. Our right of, you know, being able to say no to men and boys in our bathrooms and locker rooms and shelters and prisons. You know, our right to be included in our own sports is being affected. And but I think that the marketing that organizations like the ACLU and Mermaids have been using, you know, they've been framing this as, you know, for example, that these boys who claim that they are trans girls, they simply want to be included in sports. They just want an opportunity to participate. And, you know, it gives people that this is about, you know, fairness and their inclusion. But the fact of the matter is, it's a very disingenuous argument. You know, they are already included. You know, non-conforming boys, whatever they choose as their quote identity, nonconforming boys are already included in the male category. They already have the right to participate. They already have the right to go to the bathroom of their sex. You know, no one is being excluded from participation except for girls. Girls are being excluded. Girls are being excluded from participation in their own sports. Girls are being excluded from, you know, the right to privacy and safe spaces to be away from male bodied people. But I think that the way that this has been rolled out as, you know, anti-bullying and inclusion has, you know, it confuses people who just are trying to be good, progressive people.
So before I was really introduced to this issue, you know, I sort of perceived it that way. This was kind of like an extension of not being bigoted against gay people. And can you make the distinction between can you tell me how that logic is wrong? I mean, yeah. You just did, but can you tell me a little more?
Well, so moving even further back, there's a real challenge here with language, because what the media has done very effectively is get everyone to think that, first of all, transgender has some sort of meaning in material reality. And that is a basic misunderstanding of the word gender, right? Sex and gender are different things. And so a person can, quote unquote, identify as anything they want to for their own, if that makes them happy, right? But at the end of the day, men are male, women are female. It's not complicated. And so what people like the three of us are really trying to do is help people understand that it's really important to protect women and girls in the law as women and girls, because we are female and because we had been excluded from legal protections on the basis of our femaleness for so long across the board. So I hear what you're saying. And part of the reason, Derek, that I think this has been so effective is that this gender identity movement got the T attached to the LGB. However, what Amy was saying earlier, I think is absolutely true, that LG and B have to do with sexual orientation, right? Lesbians are women who are attracted to women on the basis of sex. Gay men are men who are attracted to other men on the basis of sex. And bisexual people of either sex are attracted to people of either sex, right? That's what that is. And it was, of course, a completely legitimate and important movement to secure legal protections for people on the basis of sexual orientation, especially during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. And then the T got added on. And that was an extremely effective ploy. And it's gotten pretty much everybody across the political spectrum to think that trans is some sort of super special kind of gay. But it's not. It has nothing to do with sexual orientation. Does that answer your question at all?
And I, if I could just add also, you know, the rights that gays and lesbians were looking for were the rights to simply have the same rights as everyone else, the right to be married, you know, the right to be treated fairly in society and not be persecuted. But they weren't asking anyone else to change their perception of reality. They simply wanted the rights that everyone else already had. And, you know, I think that is also the confusion, is that people who claim a trans status, they already have these human rights that gays and lesbians fought for. They can already marry anyone they want. They already have, you know, a right to education and healthcare. But what they are really demanding is the right for other people to participate in their identity. You know, and that is something that the EO is going to do. You know, we are, you know, for example, if a girl sees what could happen is a girl could see a man in her bathroom. She could say, you know, men are not allowed in here. He could claim that he is a woman and that he is in fact experiencing a hate crime because she refuses to call him a woman as he's demanding. So it's asking us, they are asking us to participate, you know, in something that we don't believe in. They're asking us to participate in an identity of their choosing that we may not agree to because we believe in, you know, the reality, males are males, females are females.
And that has always, when I was first looking into this, or when I was first exploring it 10, 12 years ago, I spent probably a year trying to figure out the difference between homosexuality and the transgender, trying to separate those concepts out. And one of the things that I came to was that, and you said this much better than I am, but that one of them has to do with attraction or preference or whatever you want to call it. And the other has to do with a state of physical being, by which I mean they are claiming it is a male who is now claiming to be a female. And like you said, you can identify as anything you want, but how you identify, I mean, identity ultimately means nothing, because I can identify as a plumber, but that doesn't make me one. Or I can identify as a bird, and if I jump off a cliff, I'm going to fall because I can't fly. And this, sorry to go here, but it seems also, as well as an assault on women's rights, it seems like an assault on reality.
It is. It very much it is an assault on reality. And, you know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me one time when I used to get in angry Facebook conversations with total strangers about this, and I've since stopped doing that. But somebody said sometime to me, you know, well, how do you verify somebody's identity? And I thought that was a legitimate question, so I looked it up. And if you do a Google search for identity validation or identity verification, you'll basically get a bunch of stuff about sort of banks and government entities trying to figure out if I am who I say I am, right? Am I Kara Dansky, in fact, right? With the ID that I present to them or something like that. So there's, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, Derek. This is an assault on women's rights, which comes from the assault on biological reality, right? We know that we are mammals, and that's important information. And this entire movement has somehow persuaded people to act as though reality does not exist.
So the I have two bug. I'm sorry.
They have some really effective tactics that, you know, that those, you know, they're tactics that are, I don't know if they're specifically chosen, but they're tactics that you can find in any religious cult. And that is to not accept that there are non-believers, you know, and so they go after and attack those of us who do not believe in this belief system, because, you know, what they believe is beyond material reality. What they believe is that, you know, people can, quote, be born in the wrong body, that people can, quote, change from one sex to the other, that there is such a thing as transition. And, you know, many people, I do not believe in that. But instead of just simply allowing people to be non-believers in their ideology, the tactics that are used by the activists in this movement are to go after and vilify and attack those who don't believe, you know, to label those people as bigots or transphobes or TERFs, which your audience may or may not have heard of. And, you know, a really prime example of this is J.K. Rowling, who wrote a really beautiful and moving and kind, really respectful essay, simply saying that, you know, women deserve to be able to speak about their biological reality as female human beings. And we should not be attacked or vilified or fired from our jobs for speaking about our biological reality. In response to her saying this really basic thing that she expressed in a very kind way. If you read how she wrote it, you know, she was called all of these horrible names. She received death threats and rape threats and just endless harassment. You know, not just from activists or people who claim this identity, but from, you know, fellow celebrities and people that she had formerly worked with. And it was, you know, for those who were watching this, not quite understanding what's going on, you know, that kind of mass vilification for simply not believing, you know, it's an effective tactic to silence people. And that's exactly why they use those tactics, to keep people from speaking out, and from keeping people from naming what is really basic reality.
You know, if I could add to that, I really think it's important not to frame this as a battle of beliefs, because talking about this, you know, this really, belief is irrelevant, right? Because, you know, if somebody asks me, Kara, do you believe in gravity? My response to that is going to be, who cares whether I believe in gravity? Gravity is real or it's not real. And I care about the answer to that question, but my belief in it is utterly beside the point. So this is not about, you know, we believe one thing and other people believe another thing. Derek, you know, if you believe you're a bird and can fly, you know, that's going to get you in quite a bit of trouble, as you said, because if you jump off the roof of your house, you're going to have some trouble. Right. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether, you know, if the question is, Derek, are you a bird? Who cares whether you believe in that or not? You either are or you aren't. I either am. You know, do I believe I'm a woman? Who cares? I either am or am not a woman. I am a woman. And I, you know, have pretty solid evidence that that is true. But I just don't think it's a great idea to frame this as a battle of beliefs.
Well, and this brings up something that has annoyed me for years, and we'll get back to your event very soon. The thing that's annoyed me for years is the phrase assigned female at birth or assigned male at birth, because that implies that a doctor chooses, they assign, like, you know, when I teach, I assign students to do something, or I can assign these people into this group to work together. But what sex is recognized, it's not assigned. This offends me as a writer and as a person who uses words.
Yeah, well, it's a complete lie, right? It's just a lie. You're right, sex is not assigned. It is documented. And that's a really important factor, because the sex that's marked on a birth certificate ought to stay with a person throughout that person's life. And that is vitally important for the maintenance of vital statistics and other documentation that and data collection that is used to promulgate public policy, right, on a broad range of issues. And your listeners may or may not know that today in many states, it's possible to just change the sex on your birth certificate with the stroke of a pen if you want to. And the far-reaching implications of what we're doing have really not been considered by the people in our government. It should be distressing to everyone. It is distressing for all the reasons Amy and I are talking about when it comes to protecting women and girls in the law and practically safety, you know, for women in domestic violence shelters. But everyone should be very concerned when we start talking about basing public policy, health policy, you know, disease control, COVID, right? Crime statistics. If we're going to just start ignoring the reality of sex in all of these contexts, we're going to have a massive public policy disaster on our hands, and that affects everyone.
And a tangible example of that would be that there have been men who have raped males, who have raped females, and then this is reported both on crime statistics and in newspapers as a female committed the rape. Is that correct?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's happened numerous times. There's a whole Facebook page that people can look at dedicated, just an archive page called This Never Happens. And it's just hundreds and hundreds of entries of exactly that scenario. You know, crimes that are committed by men and then subsequently reported as if those crimes were committed by women.
And we should say the reason the Facebook group is or the page is called This Never Happens is because feminists have been hammering on about this for years now. And what we have been told over the past several years is, well, this never happens, right? We are told there are no examples of men who claim to be women committing crimes. And so someone had the great idea to start a Facebook page and sarcastically name it This Never Happens. And yeah, as Amy says, it's a whole collection of scenarios in which men who claim to be women commit violent crimes, and it's reported as though the violent crime were committed by a woman.
Okay, so I have one more question before we come back to your event and to the executive order. And this question is something that has also bothered me for years, which is, okay, first, Kara, would you agree that laws are either based on or at least require or something careful definitions? Would you agree with that? Like if you get a no parking ticket, if you get a parking ticket and they would have to have defined what is a no parking zone. If you get a speeding ticket, they would have had to have defined a speed limit. What is a speed limit? And if you get arrested for murder one, they have had to define what is murder one as opposed to manslaughter. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. That is a basic, fundamental value or aspect of our legal system, specifically our criminal justice system, that says that people have to know what they are being accused of doing before they can be accused.
In fact, I've heard about some guy who got off of a major crime simply because that particular crime had not been defined and they couldn't figure out how to define it such that he had committed something. So he got away with whatever it was he did. I don't remember. Anyway, so this is another thing that's really offended me is you said this at the beginning, but I want to hammer it again, which is please define how somebody with XY chromosomes, a male, changes the definition to become a woman. What is the definition of a woman under this law, under this executive order? What's the definition of a man? What's the definition of transgender under these? And I'm going to say one more thing, which is we all learned in fifth grade that definitions must not be tautological and they must be verifiable/falsifiable. That's how definitions work. Okay, go.
Well, what you're pointing to in a way is part of what is so difficult here is that people such as yourself using critical thinking and intelligence are trying to make sense of something that fundamentally does not make sense. People will often ask me, Kara, how can this be happening? It makes no sense. And somebody who asks me that usually assumes there's something wrong with them. They think that they are the ones with the problem. How can the federal government be enshrining gender identity in the law? What is this thing called gender identity? It doesn't make any sense to me. And they think that they're missing something. They think they're getting an aspect of it wrong. They're not. They're using critical thinking and intelligence to make sense of something that does not make sense.
I agree. And yet, yeah, but whatever word we're going to use, because this is being put into law, how do they define it? Because if they can't define it, can they make a law?
They don't.
It is not defined in the executive order. They repeat over and over the words gender identity, but they never provide an explicit definition of what that even means.
Right. And to Derek's, so Amy's absolutely right. The executive order that we're talking about does not define gender identity at all, but also courts have purported to do so. And to your point, Derek, about tautology, the definition most frequently seen, or that I have most frequently seen in court opinions, goes something like the following. Gender identity means the gender that a person identifies with.
Sorry. So murder one is a murder that is first degree.
Yes. Forget about defining intent. Forget about defining premeditation. You know, the elements. Forget about the foundational element of murder being a killing. Forget about all of that. Murder one is murder in the first degree, period, stop. You're supposed to know what that means, and you're supposed to not do it, whether you know what it means or not.
And to go away from crime, so a state-run lottery is a lottery that's run by the state. Duh. I mean, okay, so let's go back to the executive order and to your event. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left. Can you give us can you talk more about the executive order itself? And you've done a wonderful job of talking about some of the implications. And can you also, I've done a terrible job of giving you an opportunity to talk about how people may participate. So can you talk more about the event itself?
Yeah, Amy, should I talk about the order and then you take the event specifics?
Perfect.
Okay. So the executive order broken down that President Biden signed on the day of his inauguration does essentially two things. The first thing it does is establish a policy that, and I should say the language used is extremely manipulative because it is designed to persuade us that this order has to do with kindness and inclusion and making sure that people aren't discriminated against. It's an extremely manipulative tactic. And then they lead us into the policy being that at a federal administrative level, the word sex must be defined to include the phrase gender identity throughout federal administrative law. So that's thing one that the order does. Thing two that the order does is it says, okay, federal administrative agencies, take the next 100 days, the end of which is April 30th, 2021. And it says, take the next 100 days to come up with a specific plan for how you are going to examine all of your internal policies, practices, and regulations to redefine the word sex to include gender identity and present that plan to the White House. So that's what the order does. And after the order, and this may be a good segue into what Amy's going to talk about, the day after the order, I was feeling very depressed because I know what this means, right? A lot of people don't really understand the implications of it. But since I've been working on this issue for several years, I do. And I was feeling very depressed. And I was having a conversation with a woman named Courtney Piper, who Amy and I both know. We were talking on the phone. I was explaining this to her. And all of a sudden, an image popped into my mind of the suffragists standing outside the White House holding a sign that said, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" And I thought, we need to do that. We need to stand outside the White House with signs that say, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" Because what President Biden has done with this executive order is effectively no different from excluding us from the franchise 100 years ago.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's really where that event came from. Where the idea for the event came from was that conversation between Courtney and Kara. And, you know, from that conversation, it's really taken off. And we chose to call our event Women Picket DC, as Kara said, in that lineage of the suffragettes. And I think there's a really great Susan B. Anthony quote where she says, "No self-respecting woman should wish or work for the success of a party that ignores her sex." That's really what's happening. Our sex is being ignored, and our physical rights to safety and fairness and privacy are not just being ignored, but are really under attack. So this event that's happening on March 8th, it's happening from 10 to 2 in front of the White House, is an opportunity for women to stand together and raise our voices and show our very public dissent to what is happening. And for those who don't know, we have a lot of young members who are following us as well, and some of whom didn't know what a picket was. So I'm just going to say for everyone, a picket is the kind of protest where you stand outside, literally stand outside a location, and draw public attention to a cause. And this was a really effective tactic that the suffragettes used. So we want to do that in that lineage. We want to show our dissent and raise our voices in that same lineage, and say to, you know, our government and to Biden, that this is really unacceptable. And women do not consent to this. And for those women who would like, please, we invite you to come physically and be there in person. For those who are concerned, we are following a proper COVID protocol. We have permits for our event. We are having for the day, we have speakers planned, including Kara. We have women who will be chanting and have drums. We have signs. So if you would like to come in person and show your solidarity, please, we welcome you to come on March 8th and be there physically. If you cannot be there physically, we ask you to amplify and to volunteer with us. We have a really great writing team, and we are involved in reaching out to senators and Congress people and local government to spread the information about what is happening to women and how this affects our rights. You know, some politicians may not even be aware of how exactly this is specifically affecting women. So women who volunteer can get involved in that. And we can help give you the language and the letters to reach out to those in your local government or state government to make them aware of what is going on. And also, people can donate to our cause. We have a Give Butter campaign going on. You can find all of this through our website, which is womenpicketdc.org. You know, so we ask for your, you know, amplification and donations, and, you know, also your physical bodies to be there in protest and solidarity with us.
So just to be clear, that was womenpicket.com?
womenpicketdc.org.
Oh.
Womenpicketdc.org.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you corrected that.
Can I throw in one more thing that your listeners
please,
be interested
please.
In doing? So you mentioned in the introduction that I'm involved in something called the Women's Human Rights Campaign. What this is a global organization of volunteer women who have come together to stand up for the protection of women's sex-based rights in the law and policy. And the reason that I say that is because there is a document that is called the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, and anyone can sign this document. It has been signed by over 15,000 people all over the world and several hundred organizations. There are approximately 2,000 signatories in the United States, and anyone can find it at womensdeclaration, all one word, .com. That's womensdeclaration.com. And there's a little button where you can click to sign the declaration.
And does women's have an apostrophe? In the URL? Okay,
no.
So it's womensdeclaration.com.
Correct.
Okay. Well, this has been great, and we have like 30 seconds left. Is there anything else you want to say?
I don't know about Amy, but I would say, you know, I'm extremely proud of the work that we have done in the past couple of weeks, the amount of energy that is behind this movement. I live in D.C. and I'm so excited for this event on March 8th. I think we have the power to make a real difference.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, although we are protesting on, you know, the U.S. government on U.S. soil, really, this is a stand for all women globally. You know, many other countries, women are experiencing the exact same thing. And we do have a lot of support from women overseas who can't be with us, but who are going through the same things in their country. And we're standing up here for women and girls in the U.S., but it is also about global solidarity with all women as a sex class.
And I guess I do have one more question, which is, this is not so much a right wing or left wing or radical, or this is a sex based thing, right?
This is a nonpartisan event. This is not any one political party or any one ideology. It is about women as a sex, women and girls as female human beings.
And I'm going to just add by paraphrasing a British journalist named Louise Perry, there are enough similarities among women to create a coherent set of political interests. I read that by her last summer and I was extremely inspired by it. We've got to get out of this right-left thing. There are enough similarities among women to create a coherent set of political interests.
And one last question. If there is a man in Washington, D.C. who wants to stand in solidarity, is he welcome at the event or is this a women's only event?
We welcome men to join us and participate. We hope that you know, men will be just as upset about what is happening to our sex-based rights and our right to name reality as we are. It is a women, I would say it is a women-centered event. Our speakers will be women, and women are the foremost of our protesters. But I do know women who are bringing their male partners or husbands with them. And we do encourage men to stand with us in solidarity.
Yep.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Amy Sousa and Kara Dansky. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio.